The governor's helping the president deport migrants, but are the sheriffs? Miami Gardens is bursting with kid-coders, and Cuba is off the U.S.'s terrorism list for now. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll discuss the constitutional questions surrounding Governor Ron DeSantis' demand that local authorities assist federal immigration officials. South Florida may not be on board. We'll also look at a popular new program in Miami Gardens to teach kids a vital but not always accessible skill, computer coding. And we'll examine the new deal that takes Cuba off the U.S.'s state sponsors of terrorism list and dissidents out of Cuba's prisons. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. You might think, say, the insurance meltdown is Florida's number one state crisis. But this week, Governor Ron DeSantis made it clear he thinks immigration enforcement is, even though that's a federal responsibility. So he ordered a special legislative session to begin January 27th that, among other things, will devise ways to compel local authorities to assist federal immigration officials in the massive deportation of undocumented migrants President-elect Donald Trump has promised to conduct. Here's Governor DeSantis making that call.
We have a responsibility to be in this fight. State and local officials in Florida must help the Trump administration enforce our nation's immigration laws. And we are going to need, in order to do that effectively, we are going to need legislation to impose additional duties on local officials and provide funding for those local officials.
The governor is apt to find problems with this plan, however. First, the U.S. Constitution, which prevents state and local governments from being compelled to enforce federal laws. Another is Florida's local law enforcement, especially South Florida law enforcement, which in some counties has strongly hinted that it agrees with the Constitution and will not turn its police officers into immigration agents. Miami-Dade County Sheriff Rosie Cordero Stutz said this to CBS 4 News.
Will Miami-Dade deputies be used to enforce deportations?
I will not have my deputies doing that work.
Do you think the governor should or even can compel local authorities to do that work? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is a top-notch immigration legal scholar, Kate Ashenbrenner Rodriguez, who heads the Immigration Clinic at Barry University's Law School. She's with us today from Orlando. And with me here in the studio is WLRN investigative reporter Danny Rivero, host of the WLRN Immigration Podcast, Detention by Design. Professor Rodriguez, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for inviting me. I'm excited to be here and to participate in the discussion.
Thank you. And I want to start with you because I first want to remind people what's coming soon after President Trump takes office next week, namely this deportation sweep of undocumented immigrants that could affect millions of people. What are you realistically expecting to happen in the coming weeks here and around the country?
So I think that we're going to absolutely see some very drastic steps being taken. What that looks like, I think, is going to differ depending on exactly what federal policies are enacted and the extent to which the states participate in this federal government's push for mass deportations.
We've heard of raids, for example, coming on employee sites. Is that sort of thing you think going to be typical?
Yes, I think work site raids, community raids, we're definitely going to see a heavy, heavy increase there. And we've seen those step up already. Mm-hmm.
Do you get the sense, though, Professor Rodriguez, that the fact that President Trump is seeking this kind of help from state and local enforcement, law enforcement, suggests he and his team realize that a deportation operation of this magnitude is not something federal immigration agents can achieve by themselves necessarily?
Yes, absolutely. The cost of this is going to be immense. The detention space that would be needed to carry out something on this scale is well beyond what ICE currently has access to. And so, I think that this is a unique recognition that the federal government could not carry this out on their own.
Well, and just quickly, Professor Rodriguez, do you see migrant communities like those here in Florida and especially South Florida, where we have a large, for example, agricultural worker migrant community? Do you see these communities facing crisis, let's say, to put it bluntly?
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, I think that is the case. Families are already doing emergency safety plans, for what they are going to do as these mass deportations begin to be carried out.
Danny Rivero, Governor DeSantis says it's every state's duty then to assist President Trump's mass deportation effort because voters in November made it very clear that the immigration crisis was one of their top priorities. So he's essentially calling on the state legislature now to come up with ways that Florida can make local government take part. What do you think this special legislative session will try to pass as a result?
So the governor has already laid out his vision for, his wish list, right?
Right.
And that includes things like requiring every law enforcement agency to participate in this program with ICE, to assist in deportations, particularly when it comes to jails.
Right.
He wants, I mean, by far, Florida is already the state with the most jurisdictions participating in this program already. I looked at the stats. We're already leading, but he wants to make it mandatory for everyone to do this.
And when you say the program so far, we're talking about a program known as 287G.
Exactly. And it includes local officers being trained by ICE to help assist deportations, to help with the federal warrants and whatnot. So they assist, but it's really in the jailhouse.
Yeah.
And he wants everyone mandatory needs to follow that program.
Okay.
He wants to appoint an immigration enforcement officer for the whole state to coordinate, state and federal officials organizing together. He wants the ability for Florida to transport people outside of the U.S. in case the U.S. federal government needs help on that. This is a very interesting one, but he wants to require anyone sending money abroad to present their ID when they're sending remittances to their families. So a
Okay.
lot of people who are undocumented live here in the U.S. and Florida, and then they send money,
Oh, yeah.
whatever they can, back home. And so that what he hopes to do is to require people to show their ID at every one of those things and then submit it to the state so that you can't send money back to your family without the state government knowing exactly who you are.
Right. And there's some leverage involved in that because some of these countries, those remittances are a big
That's,
part of their GDPs.
yeah, it's, yeah.
Yeah. But Professor Rodriguez, even if the legislature passes measures supposedly forcing local law enforcement in Florida to assist federal immigration officials in this epic deportation sweep, could any of it pass constitutional muster? There are very solid constitutional walls that they might hit, starting with the 10th Amendment, right? Not to mention provisions like the Supremacy Clause and the Anti-Commandeering Doctrine. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So the Supreme Court has said very clearly on multiple occasions, ranging back from the 1800s all the way up to today, that immigration law is a federal power. And so there's a real question here. We're coming up on this line of what can the states do legally with respect to this doctrine that is very much recognized as the authority of the federal government?
Right.
So, in addition to the proposals that Danny identified, one of the additional proposals for this immigration special session in Florida is to make illegal entry into the United States a state-level crime.
Good
And so
point.
here we're really running up against the Supremacy Clause. We're having a state action in an area where the federal government has already exclusively regulated.
Right. Danny Rivero, do you think Governor DeSantis, who's a lawyer after all, fully appreciates the reality that this isn't like passing his state preemption laws, for example, that can cancel out local and municipal ordinances he doesn't like, that perhaps Florida, like the federal government, could delegate to local authorities their help in immigration matters, as that federal code 287G that we just mentioned allows for, but that he can't force them to do it, again, because of that anti-commandeering principle under the 10th Amendment that I mentioned that blocks the federal government from compelling state and local authorities to do federal duties.
You know, I think, you know, it's complicated, but part of it's the messaging. I mean, it's very clear that the governor wants to send the message that he's ordering, you know, officials to participate in raids and things like the Miami-Dade sheriff says she doesn't want to do. And there, it does seem pretty clear that there are roadblocks in that. But he does want to, you know, force them to make these agreements with ICE and whatnot, and like and participate in the process. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not clear how far they can go, but it's obvious that under the Trump administration, with the help of a lot of states and local governments, they want to push the bar on this. They want to see how far down the line they could go. Right. And, you know, something hanging in the background in this, there's the Laken Riley Act, right. named after a student murdered in Atlanta last year by a Venezuelan undocumented immigrant,
right.
That law, which CNN as of this morning is reporting that probably has the votes to pass even mm-hmm. next week in the U.S. Senate, where things typically get choked up, it has a provision that creates a foothold for states to be involved in federal immigration by allowing state attorneys general mm-hmm. to sue the federal government to block certain people from being released by detention. Yeah. It kind of gets a foothold for states in immigration enforcement.
Yeah. And I want to go into a little bit more of that with you a little later. Professor Rodriguez.
And what we're going to get heading in.
Professor Rodriguez, what sort of a legal standoff then can we expect to see if Governor DeSantis is trying to make this sort of as Danny suggests, and you suggested earlier, a constitutional test field here? What kind of a legal standoff then can we expect to see between the governor and a lot of sheriffs around Florida who, like Sheriff Cordero Stutz here in Miami-Dade, have essentially said they're not going to turn their deputies into immigration agents? Do you expect these legislative measures that they're hoping to pass in this special session to hit the courts, for example, pretty quickly?
Yes, absolutely. I think that there are going to be court challenges filed to many, if not most, of these proposals. You know, in addition to the constitutional provisions that we've already mentioned, when we're asking states to hold non-citizens, then there is going to be an issue with respect to both the Fourth Amendment and the 14th mm-hmm. Amendment. Uh-huh. So are we holding people with probable cause? Are we right. violating their due process rights? Mm-hmm. Right. And so challenges with respect to all of these provisions, I think, are likely to be brought in the courts quickly.
And this is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Barry University Immigration Law Clinic's Kate Eschenbrenner Rodriguez and WLRN's Danny Rivero about Governor DeSantis' efforts to make local authorities here assist federal immigration officials. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Danny, I'm sorry, there was something you wanted to weigh in with there?
Yeah, I mean, one thing to come off what we were just talking about is, you know, under what authority are you holding people? And, you know, one thing to note is the federal government is not omniscient. They're not free of error. They make mistakes. And there's been many cases where U.S. citizens are held, you know, they get booked into jail for something minor crime. Right. They pay bail. They should get out. And then the feds say, no, we're holding you for immigration. These people are U.S. citizens. So there's been many cases where they're held for days and days on end for no reason, for legitimately no reason. And then they sue the local department and it becomes a liability issue. But it always ends up in court. It's a very sloppy imperfect system, I should say.
Right. But Danny, where in South Florida then do the sheriffs stand? I mean, we just talked about Rosie Cordero Stutz, for example. She doesn't want her deputies to become immigration officials, but she later clarified what she was saying. And she's saying that it is possible for her and her department to voluntarily help with things like what's called a detainer requests.
Right.
But then again, can she even do that because of something you pointed out to me earlier?
Yeah. I mean, this is something that's, I mean, it's just weird to hear the sheriff talk about it, because to have an immigration detainer, it's basically, okay, you get arrested for like petite theft. And the federal officials say, hold that person, we want to deport them. Okay, that happens in the jail. The sheriff's office in Miami-Dade County does not control the jails.
Right.
It's not under the sheriff's authority. That's under the authority of Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I actually don't know what she's referring to, because she doesn't control the jails. So she can't control what's happening in them. But, you know, further in another way, one of the proposals that Governor DeSantis wants to make into law is he wants to require every law enforcement agency in the state to train at least 10% of their workforce to assist the federal government with immigration, including deportations.
Okay, and this is the sort of thing that I know the sheriffs in Palm Beach County and Broward County have pushed back against, right?
Right. I mean, you would in some sense strong arm the local governments from doing, you know, instead of fighting the I don't know, something happening on the corner, they'd be able to be commandeered by the federal government. Maybe they say, hey, help us here. You drop everything and go to them. Otherwise you could face criminal penalties under these proposals.
Professor Rodriguez, I think a lot of people out there don't have a problem with a local sheriff's office helping federal immigration agencies with, for example, securing an undocumented immigrant who's been arrested for a crime, a procedure known, as we mentioned before, known as a detainer request, right? And Sheriff Cordero Stutz here in Miami-Dade has, as we mentioned, said she has no problem with that sort of voluntary assistance. But then again, even an undocumented migrant who's been arrested for a crime and hasn't been convicted still has legal rights. So how do those detainer requests and due legal process clash when a local sheriff's office voluntarily assists federal immigration officials this way, which I'm assuming is a controversy we're going to see a lot of when this Trump deportation sweep starts, right?
Yeah, there's a real conflict there and some real issues. So as you said, the detainer agreements are a request to state or local law enforcement to hold an individual for up to 48 hours after they would otherwise be released from state custody. So that's someone who has paid their bond. Maybe it's someone who charges were dropped against, someone who has completed serving their state criminal sentence. The state or local authorities are holding on to these individuals for 48 hours on behalf of the federal government to allow ICE to come and pick them up.
Right.
There's not always a warrant for arrest here. And this is where we really start to run into those Fourth Amendment and 14th Amendment issues mm-hmm. that I was mentioning earlier.
Right.
There's a real risk of violating individual rights mm-hmm. and of triggering lawsuits as a result.
Well, we're going to see all of this play out sooner than we know. Kate Ashenbrenner Rodriguez heads Barry University's Immigration Law Clinic. Danny Rivero is WLRN's investigative reporter. Many thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Tim.
Still to come, I see kids coding in Miami Gardens. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. If there is one skill in the information tech age that ought to be as common for kids as tying their shoes, it's computer coding. And yet only half of America's high schools teach it. Even fewer elementary schools do. And the situation is worse for minority students. Only 8% of U.S. tech workers and only 3% of U.S. tech executives are black. which is why a new and free after-school program in the predominantly black Miami-Dade city of Miami Gardens is so welcome and popular. It's called Next Gen Coders, and it teaches local kids the computer coding savvy they can't always access in school. It was set up by the Miami Gardens Educational Development Director, and it's run out of the city's Betty T. Ferguson Recreational Complex. It's introducing youngsters, and adults for that matter, to the stuff that makes the 21st century run, which is especially important in an all too often low-tech, low-wage economy like South Florida's. And by the way, it's also fun, as we'll hear. How do we get more U.S. kids access to computer coding skills? Call us at 800-743-WLRM, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is the Next Gen Coders Program Director, John Riley, who is also the founder and CEO of Riley Technology Solutions. And also with us is one of those Next Gen Coders, 12-year-old Miami Garden student Alvin Matthew. So great to have you both on. John Riley, congrats on this program. And I wanted to first ask you, what drove you in Miami Gardens to start it?
Well, first and foremost, I appreciate the invite here, Tim. It's an honor. What brought me to the city, really more so, I would say, it started out with family. It's a lot of family and friends that's in the Miami Gardens area.
Yeah.
And I just saw an opportunity with a lot of the youth that's in the community where there are a lot of tech skills that are lacking. You know, yeah. A lot of our kids are extremely creative. They're very entrepreneurial. And I just saw a space, I saw a window of opportunity where we really wanted to try to bring something that was different, that's refreshing, something that's already familiar to the kids. You know, most of these kids are playing Roblox, they're gaming a lot.
Sure, they're seeing this in video games, but as I pointed out, they often don't see it in their own schools.
Yes.
Is that something that you identified as a reason to set this up?
Yes, yes. So this has been a passion for me for a little over 4 or 5 years. My background has been in technology.
Yeah.
I've worked with, this is a family business. Riley Technology Solutions is a family business. We're veteran-owned IT MSP. And so I've been exposed to this very early, you know, into the tech realm. And I saw a space where just paying attention, you know, to my own daughter, you know, mm-hmm. and watching what type of tech access and
how
program.
How old is she?
She's seven.
Oh, okay,
she's seven.
Great,
she's
great.
A second grader at Hyatt Elementary.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I just noticed that, man, you know, there's a lot of open opportunity for kids to mm-hmm. actually learn the development side, the architectural side of these games that
yes.
a lot of our kids are mainly consumers of.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got to thinking, I started paying attention to other organizations across the country that are doing similar programs. And I just started researching, man, there's got to be a better way to find turnkey programming mm-hmm. that can be implemented into our kids' classrooms. You know,
yeah.
why is this not something that's more prevalent?
That's interesting what you said, that you saw in the architecture of these video games, for example, that
yes.
they're playing, a gateway to the architecture of stuff that much loftier in Silicon Valley,
yes.
for
yes.
example. That's a great connection. How long has Next Gen Coders been available to kids in Miami Gardens now, and how many students have so far come out to take the classes?
Well, this is our initial ramp up. You know, this is our first sprint. You know, this is our first go. So,
mm-hmm.
We are just completing our first week of the actual initiative.
Wow.
Today we're going to be having a graduation ceremony.
Right, I want to ask you about that later. Yeah.
So okay. We'll be having a bit of a graduation ceremony this evening uh-huh. at the Betty T. Ferguson Center, 6 p.m. and you know, the course, again, like you mentioned, is it's free for all Miami Gardens youth.
Mm-hmm.
We originally were kind of focusing this on junior high and high school students.
Mm-hmm.
But the platform that we're leveraging,
yeah.
that it's called Code Combat. This is a truly K-12 platform.
Right.
So, you know, youth that have no previous exposure to coding, they just, you know, play these games. They don't really know the terminology, but it's second nature to them.
Yeah.
Now we're teaching them on a fundamental level, you know, how all of this stuff works.
What specifically do they learn in the classes? As I mentioned earlier, this is not something a lot of these youngsters are going to be finding in their own school curricula, especially elementary yeah. schools. So what is it that you're teaching them in Next Gen Coders? Is this the most basic computer coding skills, or can it get more advanced than that?
Well, the beauty in the Next Gen Coders initiative is that, again, we're leveraging the Code Combat platform. And it's starting these kids out at a beginner level of coding language.
And can you just really briefly tell people what the Cold Combat Platform is?
So the Cold Combat Platform is a completely cloud-based platform that teaches kids Python and JavaScript language, CSS.
Computer language.
Yeah, so it's teaching those fundamental languages,
okay,
right? And it's meeting them where they are. You know, it's that medium of, okay, I'm learning computer science, a beginner and intermediate level computer science, but in a gaming format.
Yeah.
You know, so gamification environment. So it's familiar to them. And the Cold Combat environment has been around a little over 10 years. This is something that is not just domestically used, but on an international basis. This is used worldwide. You know, so the kids are learning fundamentally these basics. And then what we'd like to scale them into is the capability for them to, as they're building their skill set, to compete with other students globally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's other elements outside of the lesson plan that's built into the platform. It gives them the freedom for them to take what they're learning and compete, you know, on a global scale.
How eager, if not hungry, are these kids to learn this skill set, especially when they discover, for example, that this platform is really the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain that's running their video games, for example. How eager are they to learn this, especially if it's the sort of tech talent that underpins, as I said, that video game life that they lead?
I think that... And I'd like to hear Alvin's opinion on this as well.
We'll be asking.
but honestly, I think that they were really blown away to understand the fundamental mechanics of how this stuff works, right? And I think the more that they were able to grasp, you know, like anything in life, you know, you're not really knowledgeable of it. It could be intimidating, but the platform itself is extremely intuitive. It anticipates a lot of what they're doing. There's a lot of AI built into the platform as well.
Yeah.
So it assists them in their process of growing and really grasping the concepts. Right.
So Alvin Matthew, let's do bring you into the mix here. Thanks so much for joining us today. Are you there? You there, Alvin?
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm doing good.
And we should mention you don't, and other Miami students don't, have class today, which is why you can join us. I just want to make that clear. And, you know, I don't want any truant officials out there looking for you. Alvin, why did you come to take part in this community, in this computer coding class in Miami Gardens? What brought you out?
Well, what brought me out was that I really like love gaming and like love doing it, fun things.
Uh-huh.
Like, I came to the camp so I can learn how to make some of my own.
What's your favorite video game, Alvin?
2K.
Uh-huh. And were you always wondering, what is it? What's the computer technology, you know, behind this game you love, and you wanted to learn more about that?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And also when I started, it was kind of easy for me because I did something like this before.
Uh-huh.
But like there were some things that I didn't like know.
Uh-huh.
But then like more into the levels that I did, I learned new ways to do things. Cause like,
right. What is the most important or coolest thing you feel you did learn that you didn't know before that you've learned now?
Maybe the infinite loops.
Infinite loops. I love the sound of that. Tell me more about that.
The infinite loops are like basically a loop that once you put a code in under and you put space under, it's going to keep making you do that. So then you wouldn't have to keep typing and putting, uh-huh, like, for example, if I want to go right and down, right and then down, I all I have to do is just put while true and then under I put hero, move right, and then move down, and then I won't have to do any more typing.
Uh-huh.
Can't okay. forget those four spaces, right, Alvin?
Cool. You've helped an ignorant, a tech-ignorant journalist help understand this a little better, Alvin. Thanks. Alvin, another quick question. At your school, at your middle school where you go, is there a computer coding class there for you to take or not?
No.
Okay. All right. I just want to check on that because that's pretty much the situation around the country. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with tech entrepreneur John Riley and 12-year-old student Alvin Matthew of Miami Gardens about the pioneering new computer coding education program that the city has started called Next Gen Coders. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. John Riley, we just heard Alvin's obvious enthusiasm there about learning computer coding. And it seems like he's made quite the strides in understanding this stuff. And I think it's an enthusiasm that's fairly general among kids in the U.S. today. They're smart. They know how important these skills are in the year 2025. And yet, as I mentioned at the outset, little more than half the high schools in this country even offer computer coding classes. Why is this important STEM or math and science subject not taught more in our schools, John?
I don't know if I have a formal answer for that because I'm not a formal educator.
Sure.
You know, this is something that is a passion for me. It kind of grew out of me being a gamer. You know, I grew up, doing certain, coding classes, Mavis Beacon, less developed programs compared to what these kids have today. You know, it's a complete free for all. Right. So but what I see is that there is a huge market and demand that the kids have, and being able to be a part of stuff like this, and
is it a problem of teacher training, for example? Are there just not enough teachers out there who can bring this kind of class to elementary and middle and high schools to satisfy that demand you just mentioned?
I think it's a combination of a few things, Tim. I think it's awareness of programs that are like this. You know, this is something that I had to go and search for myself. You know, I just started searching for, turnkey programming that could be implemented, into environments. And this could be implemented into a school curriculum, an after school program, that's how we are looking to approach this. You know, we want to be able to kind of make programs like Code Combat and others that we're partnered with available in a turnkey way to, any environment.
But as great as this program is, should this kind of program at a municipal, center be filling the void that exists in our schools, in our public schools, where one would think that given the STEM challenge of this century, that's where our kids ought to be exposed to it?
Well, I like the way that you put that, Tim. I think that this is a start. Okay. I think that this is a beginning. And I think that sometimes
this could lead to
we need to see what's possible, right? We need to see, and the best way you can do that is by, putting the kids in the driver's seat sometime, mm-hmm. And I think we've done a really good job with that thus far. And I hope that we'll have the ability to scale this and more parents and school administrators can see this for themselves and see how this can easily be implemented in their environment and have a real impact.
And John, why is it so important that we raise access to it for minority students? I know one forecast you point out is that tech jobs are expected to grow 14% between mm-hmm. now and 2032, but black talent in that area is only expected to grow by about half that. How do we get our schools to offer these sorts of classes so we can improve that? If not our schools, more communities like Miami Gardens doing what you're doing?
Well, historically speaking, minority students, for the most part, are kind of left behind in that gap. And it's really just, most of the time, it's exposure. It's awareness and exposure. Mm-hmm. So I think that what we're looking to try to do is be solution-oriented and bringing more awareness and, accessibility to programming like this. And just showing that it's possible to, to be able to implement something in a very easy way that the kids will easily grasp to and adopt.
Alvin, you're there, right? You still there?
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Yes.
Alvin, let me ask you, I know you're only 12 years old, but do you hope maybe to go into computer and tech work when you get older?
I'd say yes. Yeah.
And is this program going to be a big help to you?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay. And finally, I just want to ask you, as you mentioned, John, there's going to be a next-gen coder's graduation of sorts this evening for the first round of students like Alvin. Tell us when the next round of next-gen coder's classes will be offered there in Miami Gardens, John, next month, no?
Yes, so we have two more weeks that are slated now. The next week will be from February 10th through 14th, and then our final class is slated at this point April 28th through May 2nd.
Great. John Riley of Riley Technology Solutions directs the Next Gen Coders program in Miami Gardens. Alvin Matthew is a 12-year-old Next Gen Coders student. Many thanks to you both for talking with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alvin.
You're welcome.
Okay, bud, take care. Still to come, will moving Cuba off the terrorism list help move dissidents out of Cuba's jails? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. A decade ago, shortly after he normalized U.S. relations with Cuba, then-President Barack Obama removed the communist regime from the State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism. Most U.S. intelligence agents agreed with the move. They acknowledge Cuba is a totalitarian dictatorship and human rights abuser, but they say today, anyway, there's little, if any, evidence the country actually promotes terrorism the way other countries on the list, like Iran, do. But just before he left office 5 years ago, President Trump put Cuba back on the state sponsors of terrorism list. It was largely viewed as a political favor to Cuban exiles. Now, just day before he leaves office, President Biden has removed Cuba from the list, and Cuba has pledged to release 553 political prisoners. The Vatican, we should add, played a central role in this arrangement. The parties say this was not a quid pro quo deal, but does it lay some Cuban negotiation groundwork for incoming President Trump? We'd like to know your thoughts in that regard. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. With me now in the studio is former Miami-Dade Democratic Congressman and Cuban-American attorney Joe Garcia, who helped push for this behind the scenes. Congressman, how are you?
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Just like about anything that involves U.S.-Cuba relations, this deal or bilateral gestures or whatever we're supposed to call it was a complicated process. And as I mentioned, no less than the Vatican was involved. Explain to us, Congressman, what brought about both the U.S. move to take Cuba off the state sponsors of terrorism list and Cuba to begin releasing half of the more than 1,000 political prisoners on the island, some of whom were already freed yesterday, you know, like prominent dissident José Daniel Ferrer.
Well, I think this was the position that the Biden administration gave the Cuban authorities. Clearly, when Joe Biden got elected, many of us thought that he would try to produce more results on opening, something that was very successful in the Obama administration at creating much more space. Unfortunately, the events of J-11 happened,
yeah.
And over 1,000 people were incarcerated, many of them very young men and women, and that basically solidified the sort of status quo on Cuba-U.S. relations. And those of us that had offered this to the Cuban regime said, look, release the political prisoners, 553 is what we knew for a fact were in jail from the J-11 still. Uh-huh. And so I think this non-deal deal, which of course is a deal, yesterday produced a larger group of people, and this total group is the largest single release of prisoners since Jimmy Carter in 1978, which was 3,000.
But as I also mentioned, both Cuba and the Biden administration insist this was not a quid pro quo deal. Cuba right. insisted is not releasing these political prisoners in response to the state-sponsored
yeah, it's just coincidence.
Delisting, and vice versa. The U.S. insisted is not taking Cuba off the terrorism list because of the prisoners.
They're both full of it.
Why is this? But why was this so important?
Because I think the Cubans believe that the Cubans make the false argument that these people were in jail purposefully, and the Biden administration, to give the Cubans cover, basically says, all right, they're doing it for their own reasons and we're doing it for our own reasons. But clearly this was timed this way, this was done this way. And since I'm not a member of the Biden administration, yeah, I can tell you this was a deal. Okay. And that's why you're about to see the largest release of political prisoners since 1978, where Jimmy Carter secured the release of over 3,000.
Now, along these lines, I just want to briefly bring into the discussion here William Leogrand, a Cuba expert at American University in Washington, D.C., who's on the line with us now and wants to make the point that it was the Biden administration, not Cuba, that kept this deal from happening as far back as a couple years ago. Bill, thanks for coming on. Please explain why that's the case.
Sure. After the demonstrations of July 11 froze U.S.-Cuban relations, the Vatican, and particularly the Pope, tried to intervene and become an interlocutor to get the process of dialogue going again, like he did very successfully in 2014. And the problem that he had was that while the Cubans at least suggested that they might be flexible on the issue of the prisoners, that they were willing to have a discussion with the United States about the prisoners, the Cubans insisted that it had to be part of a broader discussion. The Biden administration's position was the Cubans had to release the prisoners as a precondition to any kind of restarting of a bilateral improvement in relations. And that stayed the Biden administration's position right up until whenever they decided to change it and be willing to talk with the Cubans, or at least let the Vatican be an intermediary between Cuba and the United States to get this deal. Joe is absolutely right. There's no doubt that this was a deal. It doesn't just happen that, you know, within 24 hours you have these two major developments. But I would point out that, you know, this has happened a lot before. When neither side wants to admit that they're making a concession, they say, well, we're doing this unilaterally. And just so happens the other side is doing what we wanted unilaterally in the same day or within the same day or two.
Okay.
And it happened during the Carter administration as well.
Okay. Well, Bill, thank you very much. That was William Leogrand of American University. Thanks for that clarification, Bill. We really appreciate it. So Congressman Garcia, taking off from where Bill Leogrand just left off, and as he said, he says you're completely right that it was a deal, no matter what anybody wants to call it.
Right. And where I disagree with Leo is that the Biden administration was quite clear. Listen, this is the starting point. We let go of these prisoners, we can have a bigger and broader debate. And I think part of the problem in this type of situation is we've got a political reality to deal with here. They had put almost 1,000 people in jail. We had been signaling that we wanted to do something. And clearly it's not the Biden administration that moved, but the Cubans, because they wanted a broader debate. They didn't get the broader debate. What they got was exactly the deal that was offered to them earlier.
All right. But again, taking off from where Bill Leogrand just left off, whoever was to blame for the delay in this terrorism delisting and political prisoners release destination that the U.S. and Cuba finally arrived at this week, what do you feel is the most important thing about it in terms of moving U.S.-Cuba relations forward for a change?
I don't think that's the accomplishment. The accomplishment is 553 people. Yesterday they released a group over 20 who were before in horrific conditions in a jail are now going to be walking free in Cuba. What did we give for this deal? Well, listen, with the promises that the Republicans have been making in South Florida, Cuban Americans, and now with the responsibility of having 5 top ambassador posts and Marco Rubio, they're going to solve this Cuba problem lickety split in 4 days.
It's not going to happen.
Exactly. Right. But so what we got here is what we could get, which is 553 people that had been in jail, among them the most prominent dissidents, and quite literally we gave nothing. Had this been done 2 years ago, it could have been a give by the Biden administration, and we were all willing to do it to improve the situation.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with former Miami Congressman Joe Garcia about this week's surprise U.S.-Cuba relations news, taking Cuba off the U.S. terrorism list and taking dissidents out of Cuba's prisons. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Congressman, the big question now is whether incoming President Trump will move quickly to reinstate Cuba on the U.S.'s state sponsors of terrorism list. And I want to play here a clip from this week's confirmation hearing for Trump's nominee for Secretary of State, Republican Florida Senator Marco Rubio, himself a Miami Cuban American. This is part of what he said when he was asked about this.
Do you believe Cuba is a state sponsor of terrorists?
Without a question. And I'll tell you why. Number one, the FARC, which is, you know, elements of the FARC and the ALN, for that matter, in Colombia. These are narco-terrorist organizations and have been. They started out as ideological organizations and now figured out they're Marxist, but they want to make money selling cocaine. So they've done that. They have had the full support of the Cuban regime throughout their entire existence.
So Senator Rubio firmly believes Cuba is a state sponsor of terrorism. And yet, Congressman, that first example of a reason he gave, that Cuba has been a friend of the leftist FARC guerrillas in Colombia, whom the U.S. once but no longer designates a terrorist group, do you feel that meets the State Department's definition of a state sponsor of terrorism?
Listen, with all due respect to my good friend Marco Rubio, which I am very proud that he's going to become Secretary of State, and he and President Trump are going to solve the Cuba thing in the next few weeks. The reality is the president of the country of Colombia was the leader of the FARC, and the negotiations that led to a peace deal with the FARC were conducted by the Cubans at the request, not only of other countries that participated and the Colombian government itself, but the United States and the group of seven, I think that it was called, who helped broker these deals. And Cuba has served with that, with the ETA movement in Spain. Clearly, I agree, they supported a lot of these leftist groups. But Cuba is a long way from it when it could project its kinetic energy. What they've provided here is a peaceful conference center for opposing parties to find a solution.
Okay,
that
so
doesn't
again,
make him a terrorist.
Doesn't rise to that criteria. But even if Senator Rubio and the incoming Trump administration do believe that Cuba is a state sponsor of terrorism, do you think they'll move quickly then to reverse President Biden's decision to take Cuba off that list? And if they do, is there a risk that Cuba might pull back from this major prisoners release? And if that were to happen, what kind of optics could that be for Trump and Rubio for that matter?
So again, thank you, Joe Biden, right? It's an optical problem. Forget about what the U.S. side has to do because it's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
If the Cubans stopped releasing people when they said it had nothing to do with a deal, then we know that they were both lying. Listen, there's a lot of hypocrisy going on here. Both by the U.S. government that knew that Cuba shouldn't be on the terror list and by the Cubans who denied they had anyone in jail for a very long time. And so what we got here is what we could get, which is the release of 553 people from jail.
So is it your hope, Congressman, and was it the hope of President Biden and his White House when they went ahead and took Cuba off the state sponsor of terrorism list, that the new Trump White House will maybe take a step back, look at how this at least helped prompt this prisoner release in Cuba, and decide to leave things as they are for now as a way to get more positive concessions from Havana, especially since Cuba's economic collapse gives Trump even more leverage with the regime than he had in his first presidency.
Tim, all I can judge is by rhetoric and past performance. Mm-hmm. As clearly they could, the Trump administration could have done this at the beginning of their four-year term. They did it 9 days before they left the White House, putting Cuba on the terrorist list. So the reality is I can't predict what they're going to do. But this this at least gets this issue of prisoners off the table when both sides do discuss things.
In the minute we have left here, finally, Congressman, I know you're also hoping that these developments could help prompt the U.S. to help the ever-growing number of Cuban migrants here who are fleeing Cuba's crisis. What is the immigration document or status help you're urging the federal government to extend to Cuban migrants in that regard?
Well, Tim, I hoped I would have brought good news today, but you know, this morning, friends and I were speaking with the White House, and they're not going to be granting a parole in place for the almost half a million Cubans who have an I-220A status, which doesn't allow them to get to the Cuban Adjustment Act. So I'm hoping that Donald Trump, and in particular since the Cuban community, at least part of it, has been so supportive, I'm hoping he can grant that parole in place, which I think the administration and the Homeland Security Secretary has a perfect authority to do.
Cuban-American attorney Joe Garcia is a former Democratic Miami congressman. Congressman, thanks as always. We appreciate
Thank you for having me.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.